Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. I hope everyone had a good weekend. I hope those of you who are dads had a great Father's Day. Happy Father's Day to you. A friend of mine who's very involved in culture war type activities around the schools has this line. I don't know if he's the one who invented it, but it's a good line. He says, "They use your vocabulary, but they don't use your dictionary." By that, he means the left talks in all these terms that have an ordinary meaning to normal people, but in reality, those are coded in ways that reflect left ideology. One of them is public health. We need to focus on public health because we have all these issues like COVID or obesity or smoking, etc. And people say, wow, that sounds about right. But then you look at what is done under the rubric of public health, and you see that it is focus on climate change or gun control or racism, all of which people might be interested in doing something about, but it's not what people think about when we come to public health. So when you fund public health, you might think you're funding the response to the next pandemic, but you might well be funding climate change activism, for example. One of those terms that's like that is the term structural racism. You know, you can't understand what structural racism means by trying to, you know, look at the word structural and look at the word racism and try to figure it out. It's another one of these coded things. What does it mean? Well, it means a variety of things. It, you know, essentially means racism is all is racism. It essentially means that pervasive, invisible racism exists as a sort of demonic force, you know, in every nook and cranny of society, such that even if you don't perceive it, even if you don't believe that you're personally engaging in any racist way, that nevertheless, this has caught you up. You're caught up in it. It also means that, you know, Barack Obama's children, are suffering from a legacy of oppression, whereas the children of a white single mother in Appalachia who's never worked a day in her life and is addicted to drugs, those people have privilege. You know, to be honest, I'm not really exaggerating all that much with these if you listen to what, you know, a lot of the activist class says. And again, that may not be what everybody thinks, but they get their way an awful lot. And even the people who don't necessarily agree with that, maybe at the most extreme, like some of the business people, they're the ones that are actually going along with it because they're not saying anything. But I think there's this tendency for conservatives who see that stuff to say, yeah, we got to reject that. But then they go to the opposite extreme and sort of take the bookend position rather than looking at what is actually true in the world. What actually is the role of structural forces there? So I think there's this sort of and this is maybe perhaps similar to what happened with the Ukraine invasion. You know, we saw, you know, the whole apparatus of, you know, American society go all in on a sort of a radical maximalist agenda on supporting Ukraine and, you know, and all that. Well, people who didn't like that get pulled to the opposite extreme. Some people became sort of pro-Putin, which is really not the way you want to be. You end up getting in this extreme position. And a lot of conservatives are kind of steeped in a sort of classical liberal influenced view in which the individual and individual autonomy, individual agency, individual action is really what matters. And we shouldn't make recourse to all of these, you know, other explanations, but rather we should take, you know, responsibilities and individuals and do things. And to the extent that there is a force that operates on individuals, that force is the marketplace. And the marketplace is treated as essentially a natural phenomenon. It's something that's this there, it's not created, or, you know, it's what's left when you strip away everything else. Or alternatively, it's presented as essentially an emergent property of sort of free and autonomous individuals acting on the world. And so I think that's how conservatives like to conceptualize the world, very focused on individual agency, rightly in many respects. Individual agency is important. I don't think they don't like structural explanations, in part because these sort of structural explanations strike them as Marxist, which, of course, there's a lot of structural explanations in Marxism. But I think in reality, we have to recognize that structural forces do play a very key role in both individual and group outcomes. And if we don't recognize that, then we're not going to have the proper diagnosis on many of the problems that afflict our society. So I want to dive in on a few examples of this that will hopefully resonate with a more conservative audience. One of them is opioids. Now, when I was a kid in high school in the 1980s in rural southern Indiana, basically hard drugs were not available. Nobody was on meth. Nobody was on heroin. Nobody was on opioids because these drugs basically didn't exist there. If you wanted to get hard drugs, you would have had to go into a sketchy neighborhood in Louisville, Kentucky, and buy them there. You could drink, you could get smoked pot or whatever, but people weren't dying left and right of opioids. And today, people are dying left and right of opioids. So how did that happen? Well, one, you know, as I noted, they simply weren't available in the 1980s in the way that they are today. And maybe some of these were not on the market at that time, but heroin was a real thing back in the 1980s. Why was there no heroin there? Why were some of these things not there? And it's a result, in part, of structural changes in American society that were a result of conscious decisions made by people in authority. So in the early 90s, through the mid-90s, I spent a lot of time working in the pharmacy business. I was a consultant. Walgreens was my client for many years. I spent more years at Walgreens than anywhere else. In fact, we built all the technology that ran Walgreens pharmacies. And some of it may actually still be running their pharmacies today. And man, back in the 90s, narcotic painkillers were locked up tighter than Fort Knox. It was what I believe were called C2 or Schedule 2 controlled substances. You had to be super careful in how you handled these. And doctors had to be super careful in how they prescribed them. You started prescribing this stuff a little too much, you might have a problem with the DEA, the federal government. You might get in real trouble. And there was deep hesitancy to give these things out. Well, fast forward, we had all this stuff around pain advocacy. Pain is the fifth vital sign. We had all these lobbying groups from, you know, Purdue Pharma and all this other stuff. A lot of changes in the way people thought. And so we started making it much easier to prescribe these drugs. Now, you go to the dentist, you know, you come home with a vial of Vicodin, as the former health commissioner of the state of Indiana once told me. And it's kind of crazy, the amount of painkillers that they will offer you for nothing. They hand them out like candy canes. Why? Because they can. Because the scrutiny that was previously there is no longer there. In part, the reason we have an opioid epidemic is a result of a conscious decision by our society, the structure of pharmaceutical regulation, in how to allow these things or not allow these things to be distributed and prescribed. So that's one structural factor that affects what's going on in those towns today. Another one, immigration. So it's no surprise that a lot of the stuff is getting carted in from Mexico now, the heroin and this stuff. And we now have a large Latino population scattered throughout America, including in all sorts of rural areas, that is can be used by these cartels, you know, as a sort of disguise to allow themselves to distribute this thing throughout them. And that's a reality. There is a connection between immigration and drug smuggling. And that's not to say that all immigrants are drug dealers or that there's not all these positive benefits from immigration, but we have to recognize this is one of the things. You know, our integration through immigration to you know, Mexico has been a vector by which now all of this distribution is somewhat coming into the country. Whereas, again, in the 80s, it was much more limited. It's much more focused on Miami. That's where they had things like Miami Vice. And again, the distribution networks were much more limited. They weren't reaching out into these rural areas, which, in fact, they are today. So that's another structural factor. That's another thing that's a result of government policy that affects the individual level. Now, does that mean that individuals have no responsibility for their decision to use or not use drugs? No. But what it does mean is that the environment in which individuals make decisions is determined by, in part, by government policy, elite policies in the country. A second one is trade. Globalization has long been portrayed as a sort of inevitability. You still hear this talk about immigration today, that it's sort of inevitable that there's going to be this large-scale migration. We hear the same thing on trade. It's sort of inevitable. Globalization is a force that can't be stopped. In reality, globalization was a choice. And perhaps there would have been some level of globalization without making those choices, but the choices that we made are the choices that produce the system that we have today. So what were those choices? One of them was NAFTA, which I believe started negotiations under George H.W. Bush, was finalized under Clinton. A second one was the Uruguay round of trade talks, which is what created the current global trade regime and the World Trade Organization, which I believe was previously called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, a major new trade system. And then that was also in the 1990s under Clinton. And then there was the admission of China into the WTO, which at the time was called most favored nation status. Prior to that, China had essentially ability to trade with the U.S. under these preferential tariff rules of the WTO and things like that. But it was subject to periodic renewal by Congress, maybe on an annual basis. But when Congress granted them, you know, most favored nation status or permanent normal trade relations as you currently have, China was then allowed essentially into the system, and we ended up with what we have today under these systems. So these were all treaties. They were all legislative actions. They were all decisions by the people of our country who lead our country, who lead our businesses, that dramatically affected the structures under which individuals, you know, decide to find a job or look for a job. So I'm someone here who's a blue-collar worker. I don't have a college degree. I'm looking for work. What kind of work I can find, how much money I can make, is heavily influenced by these macro policies. They didn't just happen. They were choices. They were things that are actively promoted. And by the way, all of the negative consequences of these were, in fact, predicted at the time. And it wasn't just predicted by the Pat Buchanans of the world. It was predicted by a certain minority report out of mainstream respectable voices. So it's a great book from 1998. I highly recommend it. It's called Global Squeeze by a guy named Richard C. Longworth. Longworth was a longtime foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. I would call him an advocate of vital center type liberalism of that. You know, he wrote a lot about globalization. If you just read the book Global Squeeze, he lays it all out. Pretty much everything that happened as a result of globalization, and especially China, he's warning about China. It's like, we are not prepared to withstand China. Rise of populism, evisceration of blue-collar workforce, it was all there. And it's all there in advance. This wasn't like this was unknown. This was written. People knew it. All of the dissident voices were radically suppressed, which Longworth goes into when he talks about The Economist. And, you know, here we are today. And so all of these choices, all of these things that were done, these things have a profound impact on your ability to find a good paying job, a living wage, a family wage, if you are someone who does not have a college degree and works in a blue-collar environment. That's why, you know, there was all this populist unrest. People recognize, right, that trade, these trade deals were structures that had forces with a tremendous amount of influence on individuals, the individual looking for a job, and also groups, the class of people who do not have college degrees, the class of people who traditionally worked in blue-collar occupations. Another one, what's another structure? Too big to fail. We saw this in the housing crash, 2007. Absolute bailouts of major financial institutions and protection for all the people who worked in them. If you go back to the 1980s SNL crisis, there were something like 800 bankers and other officials who went to jail as a result of that. There's even a major political scandal that caught John McCain up in it. He wasn't the only one. There were the so-called Keating Five scandal. You should look up the Keating Five scandal. This idea that you were involved in these dodgy SNL loans, it wasn't just that we're going to bail out all the banks, which essentially the government did make a major bailout. At the same time, there were criminal consequences for the bankers. Hundreds of bankers went to jail. Fast forward to the dot-com crash. I mean, a number of high-profile executives got sentenced to extremely long prison terms. Bernie Ebbers, who was the CEO of WorldCom, basically spent the rest of his life in jail. He was sentenced to 26 years in prison, something like that. And for, frankly, pretty minor crimes, you know, if you ask me, like, insane that a guy got that much time. The guy, Jeff Skilling, who was the president of Enron, you know, these guys got long prison sentences. Now, he was able to get out. There was some things done, but, like, there were some major, major executives that went to prison in that era. Fast forward to the housing crash. There was like one low-level banker who got prosecuted. And if you look at all the people who got prosecuted around that, it's all sort of peripheral people who are not in the core banks or financial institutions. And now it's essentially institutionalized. When something happens, like Silicon Valley Bank, all the cronies get taken care of, and nobody goes to jail. No prosecutions, no nothing. Maybe there's a golden parachute. I keep bringing this up. It's one of the most incredible stories. Wells Fargo Bank made something like 2 million fake accounts. Their employees created 2 million fake accounts for customers that customers never requested. I mean, every single one of those is wire fraud, bank fraud, all this stuff that they go after other people for. And yet, no problem. It's just a slap on the wrist, pay the fine, the CEO gets a golden parachute, no problem. You know, but if you write a bad check, right, if a single mother, you know, writes a bad check, she's got a real problem on her hands. But if you're too big to fail, you're there. And yeah, there are people like Pharma Bro or like Elizabeth Holmes who do get prosecuted, but if you look at them, they're usually small-time. A lot of Ponzi scheme people get busted. What was his name? Madoff. You know, it's people who are sort of on the fringes of the system. They're getting busted for Ponzi scheming. They're getting busted for sort of individual acts of fraud. What they're really getting arrested for and prosecuted for is embarrassing important people. You look at Theranos, you know, all the, you know, big time sort of military people in that who were on their board, who were made to look stupid. That was her real crime. That's why she's in prison right now. It made Silicon Valley look bad when this person created such a transparent and obvious fraud. You know, the whole business was sort of fake. So you have to either be politically unfavored like Pharma Bro or do something that really embarrasses the system. Then they'll make an example out of you. You know, and here and there things happen, but systemically, right, people walk. And so what is that? Again, what we see, elite people, we have a system where elite people are able to kind of connected cronies are able to get away with what they want, unlimited bailouts, are not taking any risks, they're profiting off the system, and the Main Street guy is getting his house foreclosed on. How many people got their house foreclosed on? A lot. There was no bailout for the homeowner. And yeah, you know, maybe some of these homeowners were in dodgy loans, they shouldn't have bought the house, made some ad individual decisions. You know, a lot of people at the highest echelons of American finance made some bad decisions too. Nothing happened to them. It's another structure, the too big to fail system. consolidation, all of what we have. So these are just some things that show that conscious choices by American lawmakers, American elites, create structures and structural forces under which individuals operate. And it does affect the individual and the group. And one of the things that we've had as a result of this is we have a system that has favored this sort of top 20% class, you know, certainly the top 5 to 1%, especially. Then there's sort of these kind of call them hangers-on at the next tier, and badly disadvantaged the, you know, bottom 80%, right? The people without college degrees or who are in sort of low-level professional employment. And so, yeah, these structures really do affect people. And oh, by the way, there is a racial overlay on this. Why? Because Black Americans have lower levels of educational attainment than other racial groups. Therefore, structures such as, you know, our trade policies, our too big to fail policies, our immigration policies that have disadvantaged those sort of people who have less education, lower credentials, who don't work in this elite white collar occupation, yeah, it has had a disproportionate effect on Black America. It has. And a lot of things end up that way, even if they aren't self-consciously, quote-unquote, racist policies. And so there is a sense, you know, if you want to call it the properly so-called sense, in which you could make arguments about structural racism. I don't advise using that term and trying to redefine it, because the term is, in fact, just code word for left ideology. It's very, very difficult to hijack their terms because they control the universities, they control all these things. But the point is that in sort of rejecting the left ideology and sort of their terminology, it's very easy to become enamored of essentially the opposite position, which is frankly also not true. We don't live in a world where the individual is really the prime mover. In many cases, individuals make decisions, individuals have agencies, but individuals are operating within structures. You know, our system has a lot of structures, and those structures, some of which did evolve organically, a lot of them are as a result of conscious choices. And those structures have a profound impact on the outcomes of individuals and groups. In some respect, maybe you can think of it as a degree of difficulty dial, and they turn up the degree of difficulty dial, and sometimes it's turned up for some people in some groups, and sometimes it's turned down for other people in other groups. You know, the hedge fund has their degree of difficulty dial turned down. The too big to fail banks had their degree of difficulty turned down. You had your degree of difficulty turned up. So I think we ought to be careful not to become too hostile towards structural explanations, because if we actually want to deal with something like opioids, if we want to deal with the economy, if we want to deal, yes, with racial gaps, then structures have to be addressed. It's not just a matter of giving individuals more education, giving individuals more information, you know, encouraging people to make better decisions, although all of those things are good, right? If we do not change some of those structures, we are not going to see a big move of the needle on some of these major issues. Like opioids. We're going to have to take some structural action. We're going to have to take some structural action on the economy. So just want to leave you with that. And the temptation, again, is always, if you don't like X over here that, you know, your political opponents are promoting, is to go to, you know, X times negative one. Go to the opposite extreme. And we got to avoid doing that. And again, there's two things, I guess I would say. One is we have to become clear in our own mind about what the truth is. We have to understand what is the actual reality of the situation, both in terms of what is and what the best approach would be. And then secondarily on top of that is what is then the right political, culture, social engagement model that might promote the kind of change we want to see. It may be that it's not simply a recitation of the facts, that there are other rhetorical, organizational, political things that have to happen there. Nevertheless, I think the first thing we have to do is we have to get, you know, rooted in on the truth. And I do think this sort of overly libertarianish inflected vision is something that causes a limitation in thinking of some conservatives. And even if you are a libertarian, I know I got libertarians on here. The reality is, right now, we have a massive, massive amount of government-erected structures in our society and the economy, as you well know. So even if you're a libertarian who believes in sort of the primacy of the individual, there has to be a structural element in terms of dismantling many of these structures if we ever want to even get close to an individual-driven system. We don't have a free market. We have a managed market, managed very heavily by the government and also by other actors, such as de facto cartels, businesses, etc. It's very complex. I don't want to go into all that. But the point is, we have to really identify and understand these structural factors and how they affect the individual and the group consciously, or yes, unconsciously. And that doesn't involve having to adopt the left's view of the world. So with that, I will say, see you next week.